Hey, super fans, this is Phil Morris. Hero from Smallville, John Jones. Villain from the DC animated universe, Vandal Savage. An all-around wild guy. You are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, funny book fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. As always, thanks so much for joining me here in the lair. Great show on tap for you today. Man, we are covering a few anniversaries with this one. As many of you listeners know, I've been celebrating 50 years of Star Trek this year on Comic Book Central. Also taking a look back at 15 years of Smallville. Now, my guest today, he was in both of those worlds. You have seen him on screen. You have heard his voice in a ton of projects. The great Phil Morris. He's going to be along in just a few moments. Man, we're going to have some fun today. Looking forward to this. Now, before I kick things off, quick reminder that all episodes of Comic Book Central, and that is a lot of conversations with these legendary talents, folks, they can all be found in the archive section at the website comicbookcentral.net. You scroll through the archives. If you missed any, you can stream them. You can download them right there on the website. There's also an episode guide on the Facebook page in the About section, so you can go through that. You can link to the Facebook page from the website. You can also link to Comic Book Central on Twitter from the website. Directly, it's at comicbookctrl. There's a link to iTunes. You can also find the show on Blueberry and Stitcher. You can catch up on past episodes on all those services. Best way to catch all the fun, subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you are in iTunes, you subscribe to the show, please post a review. My thanks to each and every one of you who have been doing just that. That helps out. When you tell folks how groovy the show is, you get more and more listeners tuning in. Always room for more here in the lair. There's definitely room in the guest chair today. Let's learn a little bit more about my special guest. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Phil Morris. Phil's first acting gig came at a very early age and put him squarely in the Star Trek universe, where he would return throughout his career. In the very first season of the original Star Trek series, he appeared in the now classic episode Miri, where the crew of the Enterprise encounters a group of children who have survived a mysterious deadly plague. It was pretty easy for Phil's dad to keep an eye on him during the Star Trek shoot. That's because his father was the incredible actor Greg Morris. And Greg was working at the very same studio shooting his series, Mission Impossible. Over the years, Phil racked up some high-profile guest spots on classic television series, eventually coming full circle in the world of Mission Impossible as a series regular on the reboot in the late 80s, playing the son of his dad's original character. Now, from full-on Mission Impossible action to side-splitting comedy, Phil appeared on the mega-hit sitcom Seinfeld. Not easy to steal scenes from the stars of Seinfeld, but that is exactly what Phil did as Jackie Chiles, a very Johnny Cochran-esque attorney.
So, you know, my friend and I, we were going to the movies, and we stopped off and bought this cafe latte.
Mm-hmm. What is that, like Italian coffee?
Yeah, that's right.
Half milk, half coffee?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You take a sip?
Yes, I did.
Now, when you took a sip, did you notice it was hot? Were you able to sip it in your normal fashion?
No, I wasn't able to sip it in my normal fashion.
Mm-hmm. All right, all right.
Now, for us comic book fans, Phil has brought many of our favorite characters to life, both in live action and animation. On Smallville, he played John Jones, the Martian Manhunter. In Justice League Animated, he played the immortal villain Vandal Savage. King Faraday in Justice League New Frontier, Imperiex from the Legion of Superheroes, Jonah Hex from Batman Brave and the Bold, Wakabi from the Black Panther animated series, Scorpio from Ultimate Spider-Man, both Lego Green Arrow and Lego Hawkman, and Saint Walker, the first Blue Lantern.
Why would you do this to me, brother? Do you want to teach me there is no hope? There is no savior? Well, I cannot give up. My spirit will not be broken. I believe. I will fight the Red Lanterns, no matter how many may come. All will be well.
Joining me now is the man who has portrayed just about everything in the world of comic books coming to life, from Martian superhero to immortal villain. A huge Comic Book Central welcome to Phil Morris. Phil, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Joe, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
This is fun. There is a lot we have to talk about, so I'll try not to go all fanboy on you. This is that's going to be tough, I gotta admit. We'll talk about the superheroes, the supervillains in a bit, but also, as my listeners know, we've been celebrating 50 years of Star Trek on Comic Book Central this year. You go back,
yes.
I'm not saying ages or anything, but you go back to the beginning, don't you?
Oh yeah, I don't mind age. You know, it's you know, another day, man.
Right. You're a little kid.
Do something cool again. I was a little kid in the Star Trek episode called Miri with Michael J. Pollard and Kim Darby. Yeah, it was a stunt casted episode. The Paramount, in its wisdom, and the Star Trek people used the kids that were the offspring of actors on other shows on the lot. So it was myself and my older sister Iona, and William Shatner's kids, and Martin Landau's kids, and Peter Graves' kids, and it was an interesting set, to say the least.
This is so cool, yeah. Because when you look at this, and basically, you know, we talked to Herb Solo, who was the executive producer of the original series.
Right.
It's one of those things where, you know, it's a two-edged sword for Desilu. You know, they get these series. You always want to sell a series. And so they sold series, but then it's like, well, how are we going to pay for all these? And it was like they were juggling Mission Impossible, they were juggling Star Trek, all these things. But that results, Mannix, and that results in like everybody being on the lot at the same time. So was this kind of like, how much of that world did you know at that time as a little kid of like Mission Impossible and your dad's role on it? Because you're what, like maybe, I don't know, like 9, 10 years old or even younger maybe, I think.
Well, in 66, which is when Mission Impossible started, I was 7 years old.
Okay.
And it was massive. I mean, it was a huge deal. You know, I remember the premiere night at our house. I remember my father coming home and telling us that he got a job and he's playing a character named Barney, which we thought was funny. I mean, you know, as a kid, the name Barney was hilarious, you know, and his character, Barney Collier, the electronics expert, you know, and the show was named Mission Impossible. I was seven. I had no idea what that meant. I just knew it was a big deal.
And there Barney, were a lot of people at our house. Probably Barney Fife, too, because wasn't like Andy Griffith, like they were shooting on the same lot. I think you actually shot your episode on the Andy Griffith lot, too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That back lot where they had a desolate planet for us to run around in.
Yeah.
But
so you think your dad's Barney Fife? That's when you're a little kid until you know better.
Exactly. You're thinking Barney Google, Barney Fife. Barney Google. You know, it was so crazy. So so the night that it aired, actually, we had everybody at our house, and you know, I think as kids, we just kind of got it. This was important. This was a big deal. And that our dad was a part of something special, for sure.
And, of course, we're talking about the great Greg Morris. I mean, just, mind-blowing, this role on Mission Impossible. What a series, too. And you had to be, like, the perfect age, you know, little kid, action, adventure, all these things. I mean, that, and dad's, you know, dad's saving the day every week.
My dad was a superhero. Yeah. And in fact, man, I went to karate classes when I started my martial arts career. It was when my father got the show Mission Impossible, because they went to a martial arts class to learn judo throws and locks and pressure points and stuff like that. And so I went as well. I thought it was cool. I went. And I was really frail and brittle. And Bruce Tegner was our instructor, and he was one of the first GIs to bring the martial arts back. So I was fully into it up and until cartoons and girls were a little more important than that. But
it's always the story. Right. That's always, and then we, and then when you we get to be adults, then we go back to the comic book stuff.
I totally have them now. But you know, again, the experience of my father being on Mission Impossible was fully engrossing for my whole family, my sisters, my mom. You know, I remember Greg Morris Day in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where he's from. So, you know, it substantially changed our lives in many ways.
Yeah, and and I'm recording the show from Columbus, Ohio. I think that's where your sister was born, too. You guys spent they went from Cleveland to Columbus, and I think beyond parts elsewhere other than that?
Yeah, we went to New York, and we stayed with my grandmother. My father came west. You were going back, Joe. You're going way back now.
I know. That's what we do here on Comic Book Central. We go all the way back to the beginning. Hey, if I'm doing Star Trek when you're seven...
I know. We're deep, deep, deep,
deep,
in the corner.
Deep, deep. Yeah. How did it all start? Where did all these comic book interests come from?
Well, my father came west to do, you know, his walkabout and ended up in Seattle, which is like the West Coast theater capital of the world, and did A Raisin in the Sun. That show came down to L.A. He was dynamic in that, caught the eyes of several producers. He sent for us in New York. We came out here. You know, he did shows like Ben Casey, The New Interns, Branded with Chuck Connors. God, what else? I mean, so many shows. He did an amazing episode of The Twilight Zone with Warren Oates. So it started for him, you know, pretty hard and heavy. And he was one of the first African-American actors to do anything of note in the media, you know, especially on television. In fact, Bill Cosby came the year before my father on I Spy.
Yeah, anyway. I was going to say there were, I mean, you were thinking like Bill Cosby, your dad, maybe Teresa Graves, I think with, was it Get Christy Love and, you know, some different things like
right,
that.
Right, well, that was a little bit later.
Yeah,
was a little bit later, but yeah.
But man, these were the ones opening the doors.
No, exactly. So know him, know me, not only biologically, but professionally. And I was just enamored, you know, as I am now. I was enamored with action adventure, suspense, mystery thrillers, intelligent drama, character-driven concepts, the martial arts, visceral thrills. And I remember the first comic books I ever bought. I was with my grandmother in Cleveland, Ohio, at a drugstore. And I have them to this day.
Oh, nice. See, that's the thing. Many people are like, oh, my mom threw them out. It's nice to finally talk to somebody who's like, I kept them. Sweet.
No. I didn't want that story. I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't need to be that guy. I'm happy to be the guy I am.
What were the comic books you bought? Like, what were you driven toward? Like, what appealed to you?
I bought Tales of Suspense with Captain America and Iron Man. It was a double bill. And then I bought Journey into Mystery with Thor. I was a big Spider-Man guy right about that time. Fantastic Four was huge for me. I was a Marvel head early. Superman and Batman were cool, but I thought somehow Marvel was making a statement when I started to read comics that was different and less primary colors and you know, obvious moral underpinnings. You know, I mean, as a kid, I was a Mission Impossible guy, so I needed something to stimulate me. And you know, comic books were graphic and illustrative, and they, you know, basically they're storyboards for film buffs. And so that kind of cemented my journey right there.
Well, I think the Marvel, around that time too, the Marvel comics were more like real world kind of story. I mean, they're comic books, but, you know, like you said, you have Superman and these mm-hmm. you know, guys that can fly and that are invulnerable. And then all of a sudden you've got like regular guys with no superpowers, but
right,
street level.
Like Daredevil. Kinda. Daredevil was a big favorite of mine. And I forgot that, honestly, until I started watching the series, which I think is fantastic. Yeah. But it reminded me how much I really enjoyed Daredevil because of his iconoclasm, his fight with his beliefs versus the violent nature of what he was trying to undertake, and his vigilantism versus his being a lawyer. I mean, dude, I was so into comics. I have 20,000 or so now, still.
Wow, you are like hardcore comic book guy.
Oh no, I'm deep in it for real. So that's what I related to. You know?
Okay, well, we'll get into. I want to jump ahead, but it's like, you know, like, let's build some of these blocks leading up. What do you remember about? Because Star Trek, it wasn't just like that first episode. Like, you kind of remained in the world of Star Trek for a little while. But what do you remember of those first? Do you remember anything about being on the set? Because it was like, you know, creepy chanting
Absolutely.
Children, that, you know, that staple of early really, Star Trek.
Yeah. I remember it was scary as hell. That's what I remember.
It's a creepy episode.
It was
man.
Frightening because we were young. So no matter how much you knew about the business, and we did know a lot. I think that's why they used, you know, the offsprings of actors, because they knew when to shut up when somebody said action. You know, when the red light was on, be quiet. We were aware of the process, but we were still kids. So in that show, there were the grups and the monsters and the bonk bonk on the head. And they scared the hell out of me. You know, when they said action and that woman rolled out and she had all those sores on her body,
wow.
I was afraid, you know. So that was a real reaction. I wasn't faking that. I wasn't an actor yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very, very dynamic for us. And I made some really good friends, John and Carrie Grise. We're on the set and they become lifelong friends. And, you know, it's like a family. I mean, literally that lot at that time with the Star Trek crew and the Mission Impossible crew and the Mannix crew, we were very, very close. You know, I learned to swim at Peter Graves' house. And so it was more than just like a job, you know. I mean, literally it was our lives. We didn't know the difference as kids other than that people treated my dad differently when we were in public.
What a great playground for a kid, for an action adventure comic book loving kid. That had to be amazing. And then all those years later, getting—I mean, you kind of like floated back into the Star Trek universe from time. Like, that was your first TV role. Wasn't your first movie role Star Trek III?
I think so. And, you know, just going back as you want to build the blocks, my sisters and I would go on the Star Trek set. I mean, there was no hot set. There were no security guards. And we would just walk on the set and pick up the papier-mâché boulders and sit in Captain Kirk's chair and push the buttons. And I remember I pushed one of the buttons on his chair and my finger went all the way through. I was like, oh. We snuck out.
It's all
Joe,
you
I
broke
mean, it was it. An amazing. I guess I broke it. You know, I mean, I thought it was a real chair. I didn't know it was
not
real.
It's funny. You read Herb Solo's book, and he talks about, you know, the like shooting on the lots, and there's like, you know, birds up in the rafters interrupting the scenes. And it's like, it's really not as high tech as we all think it is, you know, when you look back at these things. You had Star Trek III. You had a small role, I think, in that. And then, was it Deep Space Nine? You makeup in a few of the Star Trek episodes. I think Deep Space Nine, you get to play a Klingon.
Yeah. I played a Klingon in Deep Space Nine. Looking for Parmok in all the wrong places.
Yeah.
Where it's a bit of a kind of a romance slash one-off episode. You know, I think they have to have those every so often.
Right.
You know, I play such a butthole Klingon that they kick me out of the Klingon Federation. I mean, you have to be kind of a dork. What a dork.
You didn't even get to die like an honorable day. Yeah, they just fired you.
Get out. They banished me. You were done. Get out of here. But I had a great time. You know, I threatened Quark, Armin Shimerman, who's a wonderful actor and a really good guy. And, you know, I've had the honor of playing in that universe quite a few times. And I think it's been good for me not to be, you know, even though I have done it a lot and I honor it, I'm not a fan necessarily of that genre. Star Trek and sci-fi. So I go into it pretty objectively and pretty clearly. And I have a great respect for it, but I don't hold it in such a precious esteem that I'm daunted by the experience. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, it does. Because I even talked to Eric Braeden about his time in Colossus and Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And he just said, I hate sci-fi. I'm not a fan. And I was like, oh, well, maybe that's why your performance is so believable, because you're not like Ostra. You're like this dude that's like fed up with everything around him or something.
And that's exactly who he plays.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? He's not acting. I don't mean to say that I'm not a fan.
Right.
I'm a fan of it. It's just not my bailiwick. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mine is more, you know, action-adventure oriented, you know, team espionage, you know, Jason Bourne, Bond stuff.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, that probably answers my question about the question I was going to ask you about Star Trek, in makeup or out of makeup, which we prefer. Because in Voyager, it's you. You're almost like pre-Sandra Bullock in Gravity, I think, in that episode. You get to like kind of float around and do some things. So I'm going to guess that you like the out of makeup stuff better.
No, you know what? You're wrong. It's a toss-up. It's a bit of a toss-up. I have to be. The reason is because the makeup sets you so beautifully. It sets your character on a course that it's inextricable. You know what I mean? You don't question your reality. You know, as a Jem'Hadar, whenever after lunch, you know, when I'm in shirt sleeves and a tunic, when I put this suit back on, it doesn't take much for me to get back into character.
Okay.
All I have to do is look in the mirror.
That's kind of like the old Jack Nicholson thing. I think what he told Keaton in Batman, just work the suit, work the mask.
Dude, in a way, it informs you. That's what we do as actors. We use whatever bit of tool around us, whatever skill we have, to be able to morph into this thing. So that is such a great foundation. The Westmores and those people have given you such great clay, literally, to work with. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you let it inform you? So when you play Klingon, you got the teeth in and you're growling. You know what I mean?
You're ticked off.
With the Dancha. Yeah. It informs you. When I walked in to go play the Jem'Hadar, they said to me, you know, Phil, we know you played a Klingon. You know, Klingons think that they're the baddest, you know, MFs in the universe. But the Jem'Hadar actually are. You know, they actually are the baddest boys on the block.
These were the guys that were in the Dominion War, like they were, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, Ketra Sol White and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it just, as an actor, it informs me. So why wouldn't I want to put on, you know, I'm sure Michael Dorn felt like Worf every single moment he was in front of the camera.
Especially after hours of makeup. I'm sure that it was not that hard to channel an angry Klingon.
Boys, no, there you go.
As an action-adventure guy, it had to be the greatest thing ever to not only be in Mission Impossible, because you got to be in the reboot in the 80s, but man, acting alongside your dad. I mean, how did that all come about, and what was that experience like of just kind of, boy, being in that world with the guy that started it?
It was surreal. It was surreal. I went in at the last hour too. I think they I don't know if they could believe that I would actually be the guy for that role. The show Mission Impossible came out of a strike-ridden season, so they had to pull a show that was fairly contemporary that they couldn't change not one word of dialogue. Not one. Nothing. Mm. So they chose Mission Impossible. And so then the search went out, who's this character, who's that, and they all got cast. We all got cast. I got cast as Barney Collier. But I was kind of like the last chopper out of Nam. You know, it was like on a Friday.
So was it not like, let's get Greg Morris's kid? I mean, was it?
No. I had friends call me.
Okay, so that role was there as your dad's son in the show, but not necessarily that it was going to go to you.
No, that role was there as him, as Barney Collier. Remember, they couldn't change anything.
Okay.
It was a writer's strike, so you couldn't write anything else. You couldn't write the son of.
Got it.
So they literally cast us as. So they were like, could that really? I'm sure they couldn't really. Really, that guy's gonna really? 30 years later, that really? Anyway, yes, really, actually, really, that is the choice. And I walked in. And I had a great meeting with the executives. It was fantastic. I called my dad. My dad and I just laughed. I can't imagine any other experience being greater than that, other than like winning an Academy Award or, you know, being the head of UNICEF. I don't know.
Curing cancer or something. Yeah, some unbelievable thing. I mean, that's just, full circle. Yeah, to just kind of follow in dad's footsteps. Yeah, and then to work alongside dad. I mean, what was that like? Just to work side by side with him on a few of those episodes. I think it was you got 3 episodes. I think it was The Condemned.
The Serpent. Yeah, yeah. The Golden Serpent. It was phenomenal, and I love my father, and you know he gave me so much, and he and my mother coming to Australia, because that's where we shot it, was like an incredible vacation, family get together, work thing, and it was fantastic. You know, it was painful at times because. You know, my dad was in an interesting place professionally in his life, and I was on a different path professionally in my life. And so, you know, we had an interesting relationship ourselves. But the work was, again, incomparable. It's hard to measure. It's almost like that wasn't work. You know, I wasn't working. I was just, here's a situation. That's my father. I'm who I am. You know, there wasn't a great deal of method soul searching to do in any of those moments. And I think that was the best way to approach any of it, just let the relationship play. And that was very fortunate. And what a blessing for he and I.
Were there any moments where he was just like, kind of like, hey, look, I was in the original. You might want to try it this way or.
Never on set, but he'd call me. He'd call me when I'd be in Australia and he'd go, yeah. So he goes, saw the show. I'm like, yeah. Yeah. You know, ours was better. Ours was a better show. I mean, literally, just like that, Joe. I kid you not. Just a better son. I think you're a fine actor. I say fine actor, but our producers are. You know what I mean? He just hit me with all the bop, 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 the bullet points. And honestly, it was a better show. How could it not have been?
Yeah.
I mean, it was the original. It set the tone. Ours was kind of coming at it from a place of need for the network and the studio. And we did the best that we could. And I thought we did a hell of a job.
Was there anything that you kind of channeled from him, whether knowingly or unknowingly, of just like kind of taking like, you know what, I want to add that layer to this performance?
Yeah, I thought one of the things that he did so well, which I haven't seen, and maybe it's been done well, and that's why you have shows like a MacGyver or any show like that works with technology well. He integrated his brain, his mind, his process with this dead, inanimate object and created a bridge to life. And an essential part of what that mission and that team was all about. And whether he had words to do it with or it was just behavior and his attitude, you know, he gave life to those objects. And that was something I tried to take and pay forward, you know, in the new technology of the time we were doing our show. and give that those things life and give them an integral nature in the running of our show.
Before we get to the superhero and the comic book stuff, I got to ask you about a couple of comedy roles. One, the PJs. taking over for Eddie Murphy. Just kind of put it, I just want to ask you about that kind of moving into that position, because that's, it's such a straight, because your voiceover work, man, you look at this and it's just off the charts, the stuff you've done. But kind of coming in for that very specific voice. And you pull it off. I mean, it's amazing. But how do you kind of come in? Were apprehension, nervousness? Do you say, like, I don't want to follow Eddie Murphy?
No. Well, once again, you know, I have a strong a sense of myself, which is good. The other is because I've been exposed to a lot of high-level people, high-level events, high-level experiences. You know, it seems to me it's just another part of my road. You know, Joe, it's just a part of my journey. And I was, familiar with Eddie's work because they had brought me in for The Legend of Mulan, the movie for Disney. And they asked me, well, what do you think? How do you think Eddie might do this? You know, so I came in for the scratch track, which is the preparatory work for the animators because the process is so long. So actually that precursed this other thing. And I just think, you know, I was like, well, you know, I'm a certain talent and I know Eddie Murphy. What do you think? What would I think he would do? And they would play me a little bit of what he did. And then I would do the rest of whatever. And then Eddie came in and did the final. Okay, so I had that connection.
Okay.
So that when they did the PJs, my name came up, you know,
okay.
And that's how that happened. So Larry Wilmore and Steve came at me and they gave me the tape. They gave me the stuff. I listened to it and I just looked at it as another character. I didn't look at it as, you know, I'm following Eddie or I'm trying to be like Eddie. I was trying to be like Thurgood Stubbs, you know, and my Thurgood Stubbs is different. Eddie's is more nuanced. If you listen to them both, you know, and I'm very anal about these things. You listen to them both. Mine's a more like machine gun approach, you know, and Eddie's is, you don't say, you know, his is much more mellifluous and mine's more. Or kind of like Sergeant Rock.
Yeah, I think there's a George Jefferson quality in Eddie's, and then yours definitely is a little bit more forceful.
Yeah, he's angry at everybody. I'm like, why? Really, third dude, why so angry?
What was the deal? Had he left the show? I mean, what was, like, did he just not want to do it anymore? Was he too busy? Or what was the, like, why the switch?
Ding, 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 all of the above.
Oh, okay.
You know, Eddie's Eddie, you know what I mean? And, I don't think he thought. I don't know. I didn't talk about it, but I don't know if he knew that the PJs would take off the way it did.
Got it.
And it really did take off. And so he was like, man, I'm busy. So yeah, if I have time, I'm Eddie. Shoot, I created this. So if I have time, I will come from Orange, New Jersey and do Thurgood. But if not, you know, you're going to have to back me up. So they hired me and I would record Joe in a separate kind of at the same time as everybody else, but in a separate booth. So that if Eddie decided he wanted to be in that episode, then they just lift my voice out of it and throw him in.
Okay. Yeah, it was interesting. I just remember that whole time period, and I was kind of curious as the backstory. The other comedy role I got to ask you about before we move on Seinfeld, man, Jackie Childs. Okay. I was obsessed with the OJ trial. I mean, I watched every second I could possibly watch.
Who wasn't?
Okay, how much of it did you watch, and how much Johnny Cochran homework did you do?
Well, I didn't really have to do homework. Listen, you're talking to me and you started this whole thing by saying, you know, Phil, I hope I don't go too far afield and go too crazy fanboy crazy. My life is absolutely crazy, Joe. So not only did I know Johnny Cochran from having gone to the same barbershop in Los Angeles with him, but, you know, he was a part of the whole crew that my father ran with in a way. And so I knew Johnny before Johnny was famous.
Okay, so you knew him. Actually, oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, no. So when he was his you know, he was Todd Bridges' attorney, he was Michael Jackson. Yeah. There was a lot of people that I was familiar with way before this. So I had already been doing homework on Johnny.
Okay.
So when I went in, I knew him. And not only did I know Johnny, but I knew my dad and I knew all these other dudes that are like hustlers and came from the streets, straight from the streets and made it into the entertainment industry. So when you see Jackie, he's an amalgam of all those people. Not just Johnny.
Okay, so how much of that character was on the page and how much of the, you know, like the cadence and you know, the lines did you bring to it?
Well, the cadence is all mine. The lines is all, I never changed a word of their dialogue ever.
Oh, okay.
Not once. But you know, but what I did bring, I think, was the sense of, I understood, you know, when Johnny was looking at you and saying, you don't say, you know, he was leading us. And, you know, smart enough while watching the trial to know that dude, he is pulling on us. And so that's what I tried to give to Jackie, you know, and that was kind of the overriding color that I think everybody related to. They liked that somebody like Jackie would try to pull something over on them with his way and his charm and get away with it.
Did you ever get any feedback from Cochran?
It was like a three-stage approach. At first, it was obviously awesome. You know, everybody, he had to sign off his likeness because, you know, Seinfeld was a huge show. Mm-hmm. And they, you knew that they were lampooning him. So they have papers where he was like, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Oh, wow. So it just didn't fall under parody and they could just get away with whatever they wanted.
Yeah, no, they had to, because, you know, because they wanted somebody, it came out in the breakdowns, they wanted somebody who could do a Johnny Cochran-esque performance kind of character. So we went in knowing that. And Michael Dorn was there, just to bring it back full circle again. He was at the audition. But what happened was, the first time I saw Johnny at the barbershop, you know, he was getting his shave and stuff, and I walk in, it's just he and I, and, you know, ba-bop, the chair comes up, and it's like that Clint Eastwood moment, and he looks at me, and he just starts laughing. He's like, great job, son, well done, boom, boom, boom. And then I did a series of Honda commercials that the Coen brothers wrote and directed. And then I did a series of Diet Dr. Pepper ads. And then I got a letter from the law offices of Johnny Cochran, Esquire, Los Angeles.
Oh, art, you know, becomes kind of reality.
Cease and desist. It was so great, Joe. So
wow,
great.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
That's when I knew Jackie had arrived.
Okay. Yeah, whenever he went into the legal. Give us a little bit of Jackie.
What do you want from Jackie? You know, Jackie says anything, he's going to have to get paid. And you don't want that on your conscience, because I have legal recourse. Know that.
I'm trying to rein in the fanboy, but it's very difficult. All right, thank you for that. Look, let's talk superheroes and supervillains. Smallville, you're coming in season six, I'm guessing, and this is just my take on it. Let me know what the reality is. Jonathan Kent, played by John Schneider, he kind of like helps Clark along on his journey. I kind of get the sense that after his character's killed off halfway through, you know, John Jones almost takes up that mantle, but not quite. Like, did you kind of see it that way? Was it talked about? How was the character pitched to you when you came in season six?
Okay. First of all, again, it was an audition process that is very sterile on the actor's end, because I am not privy to any of the, you know, intellectual conversations about the character and the arc and the concept and all that. I get a bunch of sides. I don't really know. They're not going to send me much because it's Smallville. It's super hush anyway. Mm-hmm. And the thing I did know is I knew about John Jones. Mm. I'm a comic book fan. I know who John Jones is. I know who the Martian Manhunter is before I walk in the door. Before they send me the sides, I know who John Jones is. So that's all I had, Joe. And I knew those other actors didn't have it because I got the sides. And it doesn't talk about that there. You have to know that that's the Martian Manhunter. And when they talk about John in this asylum talking to Clark, I'm like, Brick, because I don't know what I can say on your show, that's John Jones.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So all these years of comic book fandom are now going to pay off.
Okay, so you can, for our listeners, like, get sides when you, because the actors talk about sides. What are you specifically getting? And it's not really spelled out for you on the page.
No, exactly. I'm sorry. A little inside vernacular. Sides, audition sides are the bits of paper and dialogue that you have to go in to audition opposite a casting director or their assistant and be put on tape for the producers if they are not in the room. You don't always get the full script. You don't always get the full story. Usually you just get scenes, you know, with characters and dialogue.
It could be anybody.
You act that scene out.
Yeah.
It could be anybody.
It could be Bob Smith.
Yeah, and I mean, and especially in a lot of these projects these days that have this kind of high level security, the characters' names are all changed. You don't know what you're auditioning for.
Right. Because you might spill an interview.
Yeah, easily. And you sign NDAs, you know, till the cows come home,
yeah,
so that you don't, you know, unduly affect the gross of a particular project. But so that was kind of like Smallville. And so I knew about John Jones because I know John Jones. I know his compassion. I know who he is. So I brought that. right? Then I wait a month. I go in again, and I wait a couple of weeks. Then the producers from Vancouver come down. Then I go in again. By that time, I don't even know what's going on. And then they call me and they say, hey, you got it. I'm like, what? Are you crazy?
Oh, man.
So I was thrilled, man.
Now,
I was thrilled.
Were you thinking, I'm going to be in makeup, I'm going to be in green makeup, or, you know, like, what are your thoughts at that time of the character? Because we, now that we know we've got the full run of the show behind us, I think there's only even one moment where we see the full Martian Manhunter, right?
Right. There's a flash of him after he gets hit by
the way, is that
Fate.
You in there, or is that just all CGI?
No, that's me.
You actually got to put the full costume on.
No, that's CGI, but that's my body.
Your body, they put CGI over top of it. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you did the whole Star Trek makeup route again or not.
No. I told them I'd be willing to, though. You know, just like the cat does for Supergirl right now. But what happened with that was I knew that I wasn't going to have to get in makeup. I knew who was going to be played as an African-American. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was freaking inspired. I thought of all the characters that John Jones would have empathy for and understand, and that would understand him, that he would feel most comfortable and at home with, would be an African American, because of their alienation within their own country.
And that's the character.
And,
that's the core of the character. Yeah,
that's right.
That's amazing. You know? So when you're coming into it, so how are you? Again, you've already got this stuff in the back of your mind. What are you bringing to it? Are there certain storylines or certain elements or certain beats of the character that you know that you're bringing into the stories, or something that we, when we go back and watch the episodes now, that we can kind of look for? Was there like a fatherly approach to it? Was it an empathetic approach?
I think it's I've been there. It's like, I've been there. I've been where you are. And I think you read into it whatever you want. If you read into that brotherly or uncle or fatherly or whatever, mentor, I don't think John looked at it like that. I think John looked at it as, hey, wake up, look where you are. You know, I'm here to assist you on this journey, but this is definitely fraught with peril, but the consequences can be bold and brave and beautiful if you just stay the course, you know, and admit who you are. And because, I, you know, again, John's been there. John is trying in his way to do the same thing.
Okay.
So he's bringing that understanding to Clark. And I don't think he would have brought anything had Clark not needed his help, because Jor-El told him, just be a bystander. Just check him out, make sure he doesn't get killed on his way of being, you know, the boy in blue. You know, so for me, again, I look at it on a deeper level than just, you know, a father's a name, sure. But there are times when John wants to throttle him. Sure, fathers want to do that too. There's times when John, you just can't get through to him because there is a difference between him being a Martian and Kal-El being a Kryptonian. But, yeah, but in that, you know, he's trying to relate to Clark.
No, that answers the question, because it's, I'm guessing, less parental you're coming at it and more like maybe drill sergeant or managerial.
A little bit, because what they're doing there isn't casual.
All right.
You know, I don't have time. I don't have time for you. That's why Jonathan was there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's why I say kind of amped it up. It's almost like you filled that role of John Schneider, but then you took it up another level. You definitely took it up in season 7 in the episode Cure. With Laura Vandervoort. Can you talk a little bit about that scene? That's a little scary moment when you really don't want her there.
Well, there's a lot of things I don't think that they explored that they could have, and that could have been beneficial for future shows, episodes, what have you, that I think the fans would have absolutely loved. And I think that was one of the dynamics that they missed, unfortunately, and that was whatever my relationship was with Jor-El and Laura's father. So that wasn't something that was really spelled out to me. It was on the page and I could do my own, you know, connect the dots. But, you know, apparently as an intergalactic police officer, which John was, he ran afoul of her father, and her father must have been a bad dude, not a good guy. So, you know, those, it's like they drop these little, you know, red herrings in there and you want to follow them, you know, but they didn't. Again, it's Smallville.
Yeah.
They had 10 years of what they had to make decisions. They had to make choices.
Yeah.
So they couldn't go all the way out with it.
They definitely pulled at some of the strings. Yeah, they definitely pulled at some of the strings. I just don't know if they went the whole way with it. Had they ever talked about, because, man, we've got season 9, the movie, two-parter, Absolute Justice. As a comic book fanboy, okay, this thing's written by the great Jeff Johns. We're bringing in the Justice League, the Justice Society. When you got that script, I mean,
I'm blown away. just head reeling, spinning. I mean, my head was spinning the first time they brought me into the looping room, which is where you do your dialogue after the episode's been shot, and you're looking at a monitor or a big screen, and you put in dialogue that they either want or they want clarified or whatever. And then they show the Kent barn, and they show the outside of Kent barn, and I fly off. I mean, listen, I fly off, Joe. So I told them, rewind that like 20 times. And I'm sitting in this booth at Warner Brothers, in the Warner Brothers lot, just watching myself fly out of the Kent barn like 10 times. It was just... So yeah, it affects me deeply.
Yeah. You're watching it as a kid.
Oh my God, I'm reacting to it as a child, and then approaching it as a professional. There's no better way to live my life.
Had they talked at all about maybe spinning off Smallville into the Justice League? Because man, they put it was all built, and then I think it kind of became the Arrowverse a few years after that. Had they ever talked about bringing you all in as the Justice League?
Well, they never talked to me about any of that stuff. Okay. You know, I kind of campaigned for a John Jones series, and I thought he could have been I thought he could have been like a great Rod Serling, you know, and introduce, you know, have episodes of his own, but introduce other characters in the DC universe, like an ongoing anthology, kind of a dark, kind of like what they're doing with Daredevil and Jessica Jones, you know, but you have him as your erstwhile hosts, you know, traveling through the
so he would be the narrator, not necessarily like the cop, but the narrator,
like the bookender. You know, he'd come in at the beginning, come in at the end, and then every so often he'd carry an episode. I saw it that way, but no, they never talked to me about my own show. There were a lot of articles and fans that wanted it, or Justice League spinoffs, but nobody ever approached me with anything like that.
What was Tom Welling like as a director? He directed you in part two of that.
Tom knew what the hell he was doing. That's what he was like as a director. You know what I mean? And they're like, I love Tom a lot. I think he's a great guy. We're friends. But I was really impressed with him behind the camera and with the energy and the knowledge that he had technically and the ability to communicate what he wanted to the actors, which is that's what a director does. You know, you don't get better than that. And I think that he learned a lot having spent 10 years on the set. He didn't squander any of those lessons, you know, and it showed. And I hope he gets a chance to do some. I hope he gets a chance to do some of the big budget pictures that are coming out now, especially in a DC or Marvel universe. I think he knows that side of the street well. How cool would that be to be directed by Tom Welling in the Justice League movie, or you know?
That would be very cool. I think we were kind of hoping that we were going to get to see him in the red and blue tights, but
You know, see, I look at it differently again.
There's all those rumors.
You know, he did that for 10 years.
I know. That's the fanboy. I mean?
And like, it's a hard thing for the actor to go back to. It's like whenever I do a convention, he goes, please tell them that I'd love to go, but I can't. I'm busy. I'm doing what they want me to do up here, and I'm working so hard. And dude, there was no let up for that guy for 10 straight years.
Every scene.
10 years. Didn't complain. You never heard of any problems up there ever, you know?
Yeah.
I love the guy.
He put in the time. I think we just want more. We want to see him. Well, you talk about flying out of the Kent farm, and we want to see him fly. So, but you did get to wear the outfit, kind of. They did give you sort of the outfit. You got the red X and the green.
Yeah, I had the kind of like the pistolero look.
Yeah. So what was that?
Which I thought was cool. You know, it was great. I thought it was like an intergalactic Shaft look. You know, I mean, I'm down with that. you know, Joe, they had to update it. They had to change it. They had to modify it because it couldn't just be for the fandom of comics. Yeah. It had to be for a much broader audience, you know. And I think, again, making John Jones an African American, relatable, diverse, you know what I mean? You kind of get it. And I think to not lay on the primary colors of the cape and the tights, and I think it was genius for them to bring in an entire audience that might have either turned off or they wouldn't have understood it, to bring in the relationship with Lana and Lex and Chloe and you know, characters, you know, some of them who were not in the books before. I think that had to bring another level of the audience that they could not have survived just off of a comic book audience. I think it was very smart of the Smallville producers to incorporate some of the concepts that they did, even though the fans didn't necessarily agree with all of it. John Jones was never in Smallville. So,
right.
You know, I'm glad they made some changes.
Intergalactic Chef. Now you really make me want to watch that that non-existent television series. I think you got something. Hey, there's a pitch. There's a pitch for you right there.
Oh, I think it's strong.
You mentioned you have 20,000 comic books. Any of them Smallville season 11? Did you get to find out where your character went?
I got all the ones that I could get without me going crazy. Okay. Yeah, I did see all the ones with me as Batman and how great was that to see my image? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. You're a comic book guy. You got these comics and now here. It's again, you've come full circle. You've realized the dream. You know, my comics have paid for themselves, you know, many times over.
You're in them. Yeah, you're in them now.
I'm in them.
Amazing. And you're also, your voice is in them. Let's talk about some of the voiceover work. Vandal Savage, was this another character that you kind of knew about, or did you have to kind of go back and do a little research on this one?
I was not that keen on Vandal when I got the job. And that was a wonderful job to get, you know, because that was an offer, and I didn't have to audition for that, which is fantastic.
Oh,
I knew
wow.
I could be Vandal Savage. That's their genius, I guess. But yeah, I had to go back and look up this crazy immortal and see what motivated him and what he had done in the past. And I was impressed. I have a knack for playing not just larger than life characters, but characters that go beyond time and space, you know, in a way. You know, Vandal's one of those characters. And I think it's because I'm enamored with them. I respect them. I believe in them. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I believe in you, Tinkerbell. You know, I believe. And you know, Joe, I don't know if your other fans or the listeners out there have this feeling about themselves. I think it's a wonderful thing to have. If I were to wake up tomorrow and I were floating above my bed 3 feet, I would look around me and go, I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. You know.
Well, you already flew out of the Kent Farm, so it's just a natural extension.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So when I researched characters like Vandal Savage, you know, I relate them to these mythic qualities that I respect and I honor. So yeah, Vandal is a great character to play.
He seems like such a tough nut to crack too, because it's one of these, you can't kill him. So there's like really no vanquishing. We've seen that on Legends with the live action version. I don't know if you've had a chance to catch some of him in the Arrowverse and Legends and things like that. But
no, I haven't.
Okay, you have definitely a tough nut to crack. But you got to have a nice bookend with the character. I love the almost the final episode, if you want to say, of the animated version of it. I know you did the feature animated things, but kind of a nice. You do get to redeem it. This irredeemable character, supposedly irredeemable character.
Right. You're talking about the one with Superman on the planet at the end there?
Yeah, and he's making
him
dinner.
Talking about?
Yeah. He's making Superman dinner, and he's kind of hanging out, like, what, 3,000 years in the future or something?
I think Bruce Timm and Andrea Romano's direction to me was, you know, Vandal's cracked. Vandal cracked, Phil. He snapped, and... I was like, oh, I get it. How could you not? I can't die. You know, you can't kill me. How am I going to die? I'm going to have to endure this for the rest of it. That's ludicrous. That's an insane reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what you hear.
That's interesting, because there's a little manic. Yeah, there's a little bit of manic in there. And I think that's even a line of just, you're insane. He's like, yeah, maybe. It's just like this.
Yeah, maybe that could be. It's possible.
It's,
you know, and I think to play that again, simply, you know, I love Vandal. So much. These characters, you don't play with a lot of show them. You kind of try to embody them and let them show you. If that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so that's how Vandal has been for me. I wasn't that keen on Vandal as a character in the DC universe. So I had to do the research on him, not like I was on other characters. So as I see them, I start to respect them. Same with with King Faraday. And other characters that I played that are very strong in the DC universe, but are not mainstays. You know?
Right. A ton of voiceover work. Do you have a favorite? I mean, you mentioned Vandal wasn't definitely like at the top of the list, but do you have a favorite as you kind of go through these? Because you got Marvel and DC. I mean, you were on Black Panther for a little while. And
Vandal
Green,
is
Green
on
Arrow
in
the Lego universe.
Right. And I'm doing Hawkman in that universe as well. But yeah, Vandal is on the top of my list as a voiceover character, maybe not as a character in the comics, as a fan, but as an actor, as a character, as a voice talent. man, how could he not be? Okay. Imperiex is one of my favorites that I did for the Legion of Superheroes. Absolutely one of my favorites because it was the first time I played just a full on pure villainy, evil incarnate, which was fantastic. It was a great release.
We always hear that from actors. They always like, well, I can't say always, but a lot of them like the villainous roles. A little bit more scenery to chew on, a little, you can kind of go nuts with it a little bit. I mean, look at Mark Hamill as the Joker. It's, you know.
Oh, it's fantastic. But you know, I also like, I was just going to mention a character who's 180 degrees antithetical to that, and that's Saint Walker that I did for the Green Arrow, Green Lantern animated series, Josh Keaton and Kevin Michael Richardson and Jason Spezak and Gray Delisle, and a lot of great, great talent on that one. Saint Walker is one of my all-time favorites because he's Zen. He's a Zen master. He's the highest level martial artist you'll ever want to see. And he ends up becoming the first Blue Lantern. And he's a peaceful, beautiful character. I love St. Walker. Again, a character that's not a mainstay that I had to do some research on, but definitely, you know, spoke to me.
What did you find out about the character in your research that you appreciated the most?
Well, my research consisted of me going into the booth and going, who is St. Walker to these guys? That was my research. And they were like, oh, well, he's very Zen. And, you know, he's very, and I said, Zen. I said, you know, I'm a Kung Fu Sifu. They were like, no. I was like, no, that's not why you brought me in here. They were like, no, we just knew you'd be good for this. I was like, yeah, okay, here we go. And that was literally how I connected with that character. That's all I needed to know.
That's kind of like going back to your Mission Impossible day. It's like, you didn't bring me in because I'm Greg Morris's kid?
Right, nope. Right. No, no.
Nope.
Oh, good. Okay, good for you. Good for me.
You're a super cool actor.
Pretty objective to the deal here. Let me do my thing. Get out of my way. Let me do my thing.
That's got to be, as an actor, that's just got to be like, nope, no preconceived notions just because you're awesome.
It's so great. So yeah, those characters. And I tell you, one of my, I mean, if we're still talking about VO, Dr. Sweet from Atlantis, The Lost Empire, is one of my favorites as well. That's the Disney feature. And I was, again, able to play the first animated rendition of an African-American person, human being ever in the Disney universe. Nobody had ever done that before. We'd voice characters, animals, whatnot. Uncle Remus was a live action guy, but there had been no animated depiction.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there's a bit of trivia
in the Disney
back.
Universe.
Come on now. Had that dawned on you at that time? Like, did you order?
No.
Okay.
No, somebody told me, like, in a press thing. And they were like, do you know you're the first African American? I'm like, yeah, Frederick Douglass. No, I was like, cool. Great.
Do you think that would have impacted your performance had you known it going into it? Would that have maybe put a little extra weight on it or something?
Yeah. Again, where do I come from? Who's my father? You know, I live in this world. It's not anathema to me that I'd be playing a character that's the first African American anything. Yeah. Pretty much a lot of the earlier characters that have established anything in life were the first African Americans to do anything. And I've come from that world. So no, it wouldn't have informed me at all.
Well, we chatted about some of the, you know, you mentioned Daredevil and some of the things that are going on now. I mean, everything's a comic book now. Everything's either an animated or a comic book, live action, movie, TV show, whatever. You like Daredevil. Mm-hmm. Look, we've got Luke Cage coming up. We've got Jessica Jones already out there. Would you like to jump into the Marvel Universe at some point, live action?
Of course. I would love to, you know.
And what would you want to do in that universe? And have you made, has your agent made any calls yet?
They, you know, it works in a different way. You know, it's a very high level machine and they absolutely go after box office. Usually, you know, I wouldn't mind being a part of the Black Panther situation and play his father, his uncle, his mentor in some way. I'm a little old to play, T'Challa, but you know, I'd love to play in there in some way. I don't know what character there would be to play in that universe that isn't already taken, in a way. But you know, that's a place I like to read as a fan. I like to be a part of as an audience, and especially as an actor, it has certain dynamics that I fit very well within. You know, whether it's a look, a physicality, a fighting ability, a acting ability, a characterization ability, you know, either way. Well, it would I think be good to be in there or something.
We've got Luke Cage, I think, what, Iron Fist coming up on Netflix, too. So. Okay. So mm-hmm. I always like to ask actors who love comic books if they've, you know, reached out or if they've, you know, kind of talked to anybody about Black Panther's the one I'm looking forward to hugely, especially after we've just seen a little brief appearance in the latest Captain America movie.
Right, so. Avengers.
Yeah, yeah, right, I think that's right. Just going to be unbelievable. So, well, let's talk about some of the things you are working on. Work in progress. This is a new comedy series.
That's Taylor Barrett. She got a series picked up by Hear TV, okay. And she wrote a character in it for me. It's her life actually after college and wanting to be a social documentarian, and she ends up working for me. And I play a character named Phil Morris, a producer actor
who is method acting,
who is like her idol. I mean, Taylor's a very, very funny, very clever actress, and she's going to go places. And, you know, she asked me to do it, and she said, I have this part. I think you're perfect for it.
Okay.
I said, what is it? She said, it's Phil Morris. I'm like, what? And I read it, and it's very clever, and I end up being her mentor producer, and I produce her series, her 6-episode series, okay. And it's very successful. So, you know, that's a really interesting show. I think it'll be up. And I do a recurring on Baby Daddy, which just got picked up for its 6th season over at ABC Family.
I'm told there's a top secret project, so I'm guessing you can't say a whole lot about something.
Yeah, it's one of those.
Is there something, can you throw it into a genre for us? Will we see you? Will we hear you?
Here's the deal.
Okay.
It's one of those things that they make you sign an NDA, and a lot of times they make you sign these things, and you're like, yeah, okay, and it goes nowhere. It's not a big deal. It's more for the creators than it is for you, because they're, you know, they're very precious about their project, and for me, sometimes it can be something amazing, and a lot of times it isn't. This particular project is in the beyond amazing file.
Wow.
This is one of those things that when I didn't know what it was. I'll tell you the story about it, and it's even hopefully the thing that it is when it comes out is as cool as the story. I know, right? You love the tease.
Is it cooler than John Jones' Shaft?
Well, that's speculative.
Okay.
This is real. Okay, this is real. This is a job I actually have. I actually
the check clear.
They've given it to me. It's a thing. I've already done a thing for it. There's things happening.
Okay. Go with the story.
But I don't know what this thing is.
No, tell us the story. We're dying to hear the story.
Okay, so this is part of the story. I don't know what this thing is. I'm doing all this work for it. I don't know what it is. And they say it's under these code names and, you know, numbers and stuff and hyphens, and I don't know. So they send us this NDA, and they tell us, you know, remember, you're under this NDA, and you can't. So I go, fine. I don't even know what it is. They send me the script. The day before the table read, they send me the script. I don't know the character I'm playing. I don't know what the project is. I read the first line. I shut my computer off and call my best friend. I'm like, dude, let me tell you something. And I tell him what it is, and he flips. And I
already you violated the NDA immediately.
I've already violated it because I've already told him. But he's not going to say a word. He better not. This is all better. See, this is better, Joe. It's better. Because then it's like all these people are going to be trying to check out what it is. And I go to the thing that they have for us to meet everybody and they do this great presentation. And it blows my mind. Blows my mind that I'm a part of this project that's just so very cool. And so, you know, when they give you the okay, you'll be one of the first people I can actually fill in the details on this thing.
Okay. Do we have an ETA as to when that might be? There might be an announcement.
The project has been announced already.
Okay.
It's just who's in it.
Who's in it?
You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a project. We'll definitely.
It'll interest your people. It'll interest your people. Our people. The people.
I'm guessing since your head exploded when you were, I'm guessing it's in the world of comic books that we know and love. So, or at least something in that genre that we're going to be excited about. So, where else can we see you? We've mentioned Baby Daddy.
I just did an episode of Blackish that was on weeks ago.
Okay.
I'm doing a lot of that stuff right now. You know, the pilot season is past for a lot of us. I'm doing a lot of voiceover for for stuff like the Lego universe and Scooby-Doo universe and that kind of thing. So, you know, these are sometimes it's okay to say what it is and sometimes it isn't, but I'm doing a lot of stuff that you can listen for and I'll be out there. And when it comes out, we can talk about it again. That's the way the world is right now. You know, I did an audition the other day. They took the sides, which we now know what sides are, don't we, people? Took the sides, took them away from me after I finished the audition and shredded them in front of me.
Oh, just the side, not even the script, the sides.
Boom, vroom.
You were involved in some top secret, high level, checkmate level security clearance stuff.
I can't even talk. Why? I shouldn't even be talking to you right
now. No, you shouldn't. I shouldn't know any of these things.
I'm risking my career.
Who am I? Who am I to know these things?
There's
so many different things. Well, I'm sure as they are announced, we'll be finding out about it on social media. How can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter at the Phil Morris and at the Jackie Childs. I'm on Facebook and I have a website on Facebook and I got philmorris.tv. So check out all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
I have no assistant, so it's all old, but you can check it out. And hey, listen, the thing about me, Joe, is I like to work. I just finished a play a couple weeks ago, and just started this other project that I was telling you I can't talk to you about. But I just work. I don't really do a lot of the social media stuff. I could be a lot better at it. I would like a lot more followers and be a lot more immersed in that. So one of the reasons why I'm talking to you, my friend.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. You're too busy making money. You're too busy making legendary roles come to life. All this good stuff. We like it because we get to watch your performances. So, yes.
I appreciate it, my
friend. Spend less time on social network and go do those things that we like so much. Hey, Phil, thank you so much for revisiting these roles with us today. Looking forward to these projects. Looking forward to finding out what these projects are as they're announced.
Yes, exactly.
Continued success to you, and thank you so much for joining me on Comic Book Central.
Oh, brother, I appreciate it, and best of luck to you. Take care.
Looking forward to finding out exactly what that super secret project is. Oh, man, that's going to be fun to find that out. I'm sure Phil's going to announce it on social media when the time is right. I will put the links to his Twitter and Facebook pages in the show notes for this episode at my website so you can catch up with him there. You're going to find that comicbookcentral.net, the show notes. Click those links. You can follow Phil on social media. Again, my thanks to Phil Morris for stopping by, talking about all these different roles. And man, for channeling Jackie Childs once again, that was awesome. Really enjoyed that. That was fun. All right, we are having all kinds of fun each and every week right here on Comic Book Central. If you are new to the show and you want to get in on the fun, the best way is to subscribe to the show on iTunes. You get all the episodes that way. Take them with you on your road trips, your vacations. You can catch up on the episodes you might have missed. A lot of good Smallville ones out there as well. Michael Rosenbaum, John Schneider, Laura Vandervoort, a bunch of others. So check them out. Episode guide is on the Facebook page in the About section. Share the episodes every Saturday on Facebook. Retweet them on Twitter. Share the lair. Hashtag share the lair. Thanks to each and every one of you who are doing just that. It really does get the show out to a bigger audience. You get them to all your friends and family. They can check it out. More people get in on the fun. When you head to the comic book store, if you're standing in line at San Diego Comic-Con, tell everyone about the show. Let them know about it. They can enjoy it and get in on the fun as well. And I want to hear from you. If you have a favorite comic book movie or TV show, if you have some guest ideas, are there anniversaries we need to celebrate? What are you looking forward to seeing coming up? Wonder Woman, Black Panther, Justice League, a lot of good stuff coming. Let me know what's on your mind. You can click that Signal Me tab on the website or send an email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. All right, kids, that's it for today. Martian Manhunter and I are going to go split a package of Oreo cookies over at the Kent Farm. But not to worry, I will be back before you know it, because next week on Comic Book Central, I've been hinting at it for a few episodes now. Next week, I'm talking Supergirl, one of my favorite shows from last season. Next week, the actor who brings the iconic character of James Olsen to life on the show, he's going to be right here, Mikad Brooks in the lair. We're going to be talking about Supergirl. We're going to be talking about Superman. Superman's going to show up on the show this fall. We're going to talk bow ties, signal watches, and what's next for the show as it heads to the DC Universe on the CW. Makkad Brooks is coming your way next time. Until then, have an amazing week. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Imported License. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Then what happened?
Well, you know, they don't allow outside drinks in the movie theater, so I had to put it in my shirt and sneak it in.
Yeah, see, they like to sell their own coffee.
Yeah. Now, is that going to be a problem?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem for them. It's a clear violation of your rights as a consumer. It's an infringement on your constitutional rights. It's outrageous, egregious, preposterous.
It's definitely preposterous.